This is New Beginnings, hosted by award-winning broadcaster and speaker Freddie Bell. A program for and about America's 78 million baby boomers. Here's your host, Freddie Bell.
Hi, everyone. This is New Beginnings. I am Freddie Bell. Glad you're with us today. And coming up on the show, many of our favorite partners, including Leibel Sternbach is here, Joe McKenzie, and friends from AARP Minnesota. All this plus the words to the wise on New Beginnings. And our program is underway right now. And joining us now is John Schwartz. He's the president of the Center for Combating Elder Financial Abuse. John, hello and welcome back.
Hey, Freddie. Thank you very much for having me.
I have a fundamental question for you, John. What is elder financial abuse?
Thank you very much. How I'll answer that, Freddie, is first of all, it's a predator crime. I don't call it a family matter, a civil matter, or a bad investment. What I do call it is a financial predator that targets the most vulnerable elderly and then start exploiting them using their various attack vectors to steal either a portion or all of their life savings. But it's a predator attack.
Predator attack. So how do they go about this? Do they run into you at the mall or something like that and size you up? How does it work?
That's a great question. So what happens, Freddie, you have two types of predators. You have hide in the shadows predators and hide in plain sight. So these hide in plain sight predators, some of these individuals will run Ponzi schemes and they'll hold seminars. They'll bring you into these seminars and then they'll offer you their incredible investments. One predator I want to highlight is Scott Cohen, and not very few people have heard of Scott Cohen. He pled guilty August 18th, 2022 to a 10-year sentence after stealing $300 million through a Ponzi scheme that targeted retirees and military pension holders. And in this scheme, he was able to exploit more than 13,000 veterans through exploitative loans. So that's wow. Just one example of an attack vector, a Ponzi scheme, which in my research, I'm finding is to be very, very effective. But I want the listeners to know there's an individual by the name of Scott Cohen who was capable of stealing $300 million and targeting the elderly.
So you're saying he successfully stole $300 million?
Yeah, absolutely. So if your listeners go to our website on the very front page, I have featured content and his stories there. And if they click on that, they'll come to the Department of Justice press release dated August 18th that describes, the title of it is California man receives 10-year sentence following guilty plea in South Carolina to fraud conspiracy. And then following that, it says masterminded $300 million Ponzi scheme targeting retirees and military pension holders. So, yeah, this guy's out there and we make this information readily available for all your listeners.
You mentioned to me the other day about Doc Gallagher, who was also in radio. It makes me kind of concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up. You should be concerned. So Doc Gallagher is also on our website. He was sentenced, I believe, November 1st, 2021, to three life terms, but he only stole $32 million. So you can go to my website and you can compare and contrast. But let's talk about Doc Gallagher. He was on Christian radio in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and he effectively stole $32 million from approximately 190 individuals by putting himself out on Christian radio, as well as going around various churches. So, yeah, he used the same technique as Scott Cohen, a Ponzi scheme, a little bit different ways of reaching out to the most vulnerable elderly.
So what do we do, John, to stop this kind of abuse? How do we protect ourselves?
I tell you what, the first suggestion that I have is for the elderly and their family members to get together and conduct a risk assessment. The elderly in the mid-60s, married, still has a spouse, and they're active 3-4 days a week playing golf, going to church. They're at low risk. But you take that person and you compare it to an individual in their mid-70s, maybe lost a spouse, kids don't live close by, and now they're somewhat isolated. Now they're at a higher risk. And the reason I say conduct this assessment, because that's exactly what the predators do. And then once you assess yourself through the risk assessment, then take appropriate measures. Please visit the website. I have educational material on that. If you feel that yourself or a family member's at high risk, spend 15, 20 minutes taking a look at the information I have, and maybe that will help you develop your own strategies to protect your loved one.
So tell us the website again, and how can we get in contact with you?
Thank you. So our website is endefa.org, and I'll spell it. It's endefa.org. So please visit the website. There's a button to contact me. And if you want to reach out to me, reach out through the website.
All right, John, I can't thank you enough. And thank you for raising our antennas about elder financial abuse. You got me really concerned. Let's talk again real soon.
Thank you, Freddie.
Okay.
And now, our supporting partner, AARP in the Twin Cities.
And joining us now, we turn our attention to Kathy McClear, AARP Minnesota State Director. And we want to save time, but we also like to save money. Kathy McClear, hello and welcome back. Let's talk about savings and planning.
Thanks, Freddie. This is such an important issue. And I can't stress enough that, you know, we really are facing kind of a retirement crisis, and a secure retirement, whatever age you decide that's going to be, is all too often out of reach for so many people. We know that nearly half of Americans nearing retirement age, which I think typically we tend to think of 65 years and older. Of course, many people are working longer these days because they choose to, but many work longer because they have to. Nearly half of those Americans who are nearing retirement age have less than $25,000 put away, while one in four has less than $1,000 in savings.
Wow. So that makes it really difficult. Even, 65, we understand that your expenses start to go down, but even at that level, that's pretty difficult to live, isn't it?
Well, it is. And really, AARP, we want to make sure that your money lives as long as you do. And we know that while maybe your expenses go down, often, you know, once you hit age 65 and older, your healthcare expenses go up. And so it really is a matter of planning for your future, making sure you understand what needs you're going to have in retirement, and then, you know, making some decisions to help your money last long enough.
Social Security benefits are out there, but I've heard you say on this program that that's not nearly enough.
Yeah, in Minnesota, the average Social Security benefit check for folks 65 and older is just over $1,700 a month. And we know that close to half of retirees 65 and older rely on that Social Security income for at least half of their income. But, you know, Freddie, what I think is really challenging is there are many disparities when you look at that earned benefit that Social Security provides. So I said that average Social Security benefit is $1,700 a month. For women in Minnesota, it's $1,500 a month. And then when you talk about women of color, it is far less, receiving on average between $940 a month and $1,250 a month. And so while Social Security is very much a safety net, it was never intended to be a person's sole source of their income in retirement. And it's so important to have those personal savings, as well as taking advantage of any workplace retirement plans that you might have access to.
So what does AARP propose? What can help to bridge that gap and to increase the income, if that's possible, of your retirees and members?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of kind of common sense things. And if you plan on working into retirement, making sure you're keeping those job skills up to date. Certainly managing your debt. If you go into retirement with a lot of debt, that's really going to hurt your prospects of having a secure financial future. Lots of folks don't know this. You can claim Social Security at age 62, but the longer you wait, if you wait until that full retirement age, so for me, it's about 67 and a half, but if you wait even until the age of 70, that's going to result in a larger monthly benefit, which can really have a significant impact on your financial security later in life. And then finally, you know, if you are someone who is relying on that Social Security benefit for a majority of your income, it's really important to determine your eligibility for some of those public assistance programs. So things like maybe SNAP or the Medicare Savings Program or any types of property tax relief that might be available to you. So it's really important to stay informed and do your homework so you can really have a secure financial future.
It's a complex situation. Is there a place or a resource that we can go to get more information about Social Security and other programs that are really beneficial to your retirees and members?
Sure. You know, a great place to start is aarp.org, and then just put into the search anything that that might be helpful. So whether it's Money Map that can help you pay down debt, or student loans, if you are someone who still has student loans, or work if you're looking for some of those job skills. So aarp.org is a great place to start.
Kathy, you always have great information for us, and we'll be right back with more on New Beginnings. Just for fun this week on New Beginnings, a new poll shows that half of Americans believe the United States is in recession. Mind you, most Americans really can't define a recession. 10% of those polled think a recession is when the buffet runs out of pudding. Junk food doesn't actually make you happy. Emotional eating is no longer the answer. According to the researchers at Penn State, people don't actually feel better after eating junk food. In fact, they often feel worse. In their study, subjects who were in a good mood before eating tended to have no mood changes, regardless of eating behaviors. But people who were in bad moods tended to become more negative when eating unhealthy snacks. And women worry more than men. This comes as a shock to nobody, especially moms. A study discovered that women were more than likely than men to feel nervous, anxious, and worried, 22% to 16%. Younger and middle-aged men and women seem to be the most stressed. The good news, the older you get, the happier and less stressed you are. And a third of adults suffer from nocturia. If someone is dragging at work today, it's probably because they got up to use the bathroom in the middle of the night. They call it nocturia, when a person gets up once or more during the night to go to the restroom. Experts say that people with nocturia lose a quarter of their productivity at work the next day. A third of adults suffer from the condition. And here are four things you didn't know yesterday. It's time to upgrade your IQ. Fish can count to four. Number two, a study found that bar customers finished a drink in 11 and a half minutes with loud music compared to 14 and a half minutes with normal volume. Number three, on May 30th, 2003, the Washington Post misspelled the name of the National Spelling Bee winner. And number four, the British invented ketchup. Four things you probably didn't know today. And it's crazy, but it's true. A bus driver was pretty perplexed when he pulled up to a curb in the United Kingdom, and a parking warden immediately stepped up and gave him a ticket for blocking a bus stop. The bus driver was perplexed because he was behind the wheel of an actual bus that had stopped there to let passengers board. The warden told him the zone was restricted. The bus driver asked, "Restricted to who?" He was told, "Buses." While the parking warden didn't understand the irony, the city council did. It canceled the ticket. Just for fun this week on New Beginnings. Get the most from AARP, including advice and support to help you care for your loved ones. Fraud prevention with tips and tools to help protect you from scams and fraud, including a free helpline if you've been targeted, a scam tracking map, and watchdog alerts via email through the AARP Fraud Watch Network. If you don't know AARP, you don't know ARP.
More information at AARP.org.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Hi again, everyone, and welcome back to New Beginnings. A great discussion we've been having today so far. Now with us is Joe McKenzie. He is the founder of Ripple Connects. He turns candidates into contenders. If you'd like to reach out to Joe McKenzie, you can visit his website at rippleconnects.com. And you can reach him by phone if you like at 763-438-1621. Joe McKenzie, as I see that we're fully into spring now. And I want to say, first of all, happy spring.
Thank you, Freddie Bell. We definitely earned this year's springtime after the winter we've had.
Absolutely. You know, things have been dormant for so long, and now I'm beginning to see just some green haze on the trees, some budding. And it makes me think about somebody who is reemerging and trying to restart their job search. And let's talk about re-energizing your job search, consistent with the springtime. So is this a good time to restart or recalibrate an individual search for a new career, or to even get promoted where they are.
Absolutely, Freddie. And it's each an individual thing. If someone's been trying hard since, say, last fall or earlier this winter to find a new position in their job search and they've come up short or they feel like they haven't made progress, re-energizing your job search is critical for you to keep moving towards where you want to be. And this is a good time. I think winter, some people will be traveling to warmer climates. They may be unwilling to meet or be in town. So yes, this is a great opportunity for that person whose job search has stalled. And everybody needs that. You know, if we talk about spring as that point of optimism, who doesn't need optimism when you have a job search that you feel has stalled and you need to pump new energy into it? Yes, this is a perfect time of year to do so.
So we're talking about re-energizing your job search. What would be a touch point for this week that someone can put into an effect like right away in order to inject new energy into that job search?
And that's the key. What can you do this weekend, or what can you think about this weekend that will get your week off to a good start? And one of them is just make it a point to stay in touch, keep in touch with your bench of advocates. If 60 or 90 days have passed and you haven't shared with them some new information that you have about your job search, what you're running up against, what industry that you're targeting, what transferable skill that you've kind of you've been marketing for yourself, what better way to re-energize to the people that know you the best? And those are the bench of advocates we've talked about, the people that know you, that trust you, that have worked with you. That would be the easiest step this week, Freddie. And it doesn't have to be 16 people. It could be two people that you want to reach out to that you haven't talked with that might help put that new energy, re-energize your job search.
That's really good advice. Now, what about, you know, we've got this bench of advocates. We understand what that's all about. People who know us best, they can help direct us into some unforeseen opportunities and really help in that regard. But what causes us to be disconnected from these people who've helped us so much in the past?
I think at times we are reluctant to reach out to someone if we haven't made a lot of progress. We feel like we haven't really earned the right to go back to them and say, hey, this is where I'm at in my job search. It may feel like we're being a burden to them or, you know, just taking away from their own life. But if you really think about your job search, you may have a piece of information that's new, that's timely, that you want to share with them. And maybe you don't sit down with them for an hour coffee meeting. It might be a catch-up phone call, Freddie, or a message on social media platform just to say, hey, this is a new piece of information I want to share with you about my search. All effective ways to reconnect, stay in touch with those advocates, and overcome that self-limiting thought process that, hey, I don't have a lot to share with them, or I'm burdening them because I talked with them 90 days ago. I think we have to get outside that mindset. And most of our advocates are going to say, I would say all of our advocates are going to say, good for you. That's great information. But Freddie, what if they say, and here's what I know about that industry. Here's what I know about that resource. Wouldn't that be a moment of where you feel like your job search is being re-energized when someone adds to it their own take, their own insights?
That's the best, I think, because now they're really involved with you because they're adding from their own knowledge base into your job search.
Absolutely. And that's where you start to get traction. That's where you stop internalizing so much of the mindset you've had that maybe your job search is not moving forward. One piece of information from a couple different people may be what it takes to get that momentum in place.
Everyone, we're talking with Joe McKenzie about re-energizing your job search. So what else can we do? So we made contact. So that was step one. We recontacted our bench of advocates. What would be step two this weekend?
I think this is a little bit more. Here's how I put it. Speaking with people that are completely outside your industry helps you to gain some kind of insight on where you've been and where you could go. Often we gravitate towards people that may be in our similar industry. So if I'm working in the nonprofit, well, maybe I should only talk people that are in the nonprofit because they know me the best. But what if you have friends or you have trusted people that you know that are in the tech industry or government or healthcare? This step will allow you to think more critically about your existing skill sets, your transferable skills, and what's marketable. That's a little, you know, scarier step for some people that feel that I have no business being in healthcare or tech or government. But Freddie, what that does is it brings that diversity of thinking about how you could be valued in different industries. We have to pull people in occasionally to stretch and expand our job search. Otherwise, we get too myopic. Maybe I'm only qualified for this industry. What if that industry is struggling? So you make it a point to talk to people that are in different industries that you've ever been. That does help stretch your thinking and expand your search.
And thinking about that, it makes me think that you could really be exposed to new opportunities where you're relating the previously unrelated.
Yes, absolutely. And what better way to hear it from someone that knows you and trusts you and wants to champion you versus looking on the internet and said, I'm not qualified to ever go into healthcare because I just don't see it. Well, what if someone says, well, this is what's needed in healthcare today, or this is what's needed in government today, this is what's needed in the nonprofit today? What better way to hear it from someone that cares about you? And that's why I instruct my clients to say, get outside your comfort zone a little bit. And that should help at least at a minimum, expand your search and your horizons for where you could target.
Now, we were talking about getting started this weekend, but I've also heard you say that it's not necessary to go full out 100 miles an hour in the job search. You need some time for yourself as well, correct?
Absolutely. That creative downtime. We talk about spring. What if we could take a day trip to one of the areas in Minnesota now that it's spring? Being outside, connected to nature, connected to a cup of coffee with a good friend, reading a book. That is a great way for you to kind of reflect upon where you are and where you want to go. And that is a good chance for you to kind of recharge and reset. And ultimately, what you're trying to do is re-energize your job search. But that creative downtime, you're sitting on your deck and that warm sun is hitting you and you realize, I haven't reached out to this person in a while. Or that's a resource I never really thought about exploring, but now I feel re-energized because I took the time to be good to myself and to reset, recharge, and ultimately re-energize your own job search.
I can just see it now. I'm visualizing sitting on the deck, even though I do see snow through the windows in the distance. That's a great affirmation. So recapping points 1, 2, and 3, Joe McKenzie?
Keep in touch. Find ways to share new information with your bench of advocates in your network. Even though it may have been a couple months, share that new information. You want that person that you talk with to add their own insights. 2, proactively set up meetings with people or coffee meetings, phone calls with people that are completely outside your own industry to help expand your horizons, expand your search. And then also make sure you carve out that creative downtime, be good to yourself, embrace the spring, but come at it from a creative way to re-energize that job search.
Seems to me this is how you turn candidates into contenders. And for more information, what's that website again?
That's rippleconnects.com.
All right, Joe McKenzie, and this is New Beginnings. Thanks for being with us this weekend on New Beginnings, and it happened this week in 1954. The CBS television morning show debuted with Walter Cronkite as the host. In 1966, Basketball Hall of Famer Abe Saperstein died at the age of 62. He founded the Harlem Globetrotters. In 71, CBS television announced that it would drop the Ed Sullivan Show after 23 years on the network. In 88, the NFL St. Louis Cardinals officially moved to Phoenix, Arizona. In 1991, 4 Los Angeles police officers were charged with beating motorist Rodney King. And in 2000, announcer and game show host Derwood Kirby died in Fort Myers, Florida. He was 88 years old. It happened this week, and I'm Freddie Bell.
This is a news-oriented broadcast, and all information is educational in nature, is not intended to be legal, securities, tax, or insurance advice. Please consult with the appropriate professional before acting on information heard during the broadcast.
You're listening to New Beginnings. New Beginnings with Freddie Bell.
Now let's turn our attention to your financial health in retirement. And with us is Leibel Sternbach. He is an Amazon best-selling author of Living with Financial Anxiety and Authenticity. Leibel, hello and welcome back to New Beginnings.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Unbelievable. Glad that you're with us. And what a timely topic for us to chat about today. So walk us through, if you don't mind, Leibel, about what happened with Silicon Valley Bank.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise, but so Silicon Valley Bank is a niche bank, so to speak, right? They really focus on their niche, which is the tech sector, and they help fund a lot of the startups in Silicon Valley. That's where all the startups go for their banking needs. And so they ended up in this very weird and odd situation that to me looks very similar to what a lot of retirees who have worked their entire life, you know, to accumulate their wealth and get to this point where they have this large amount of savings and, you know, they've got their income in excess of their expenses. And that's kind of what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. They were so successful that they were actually their own downfall. They were so successful at helping the startup community and that people were just throwing money at them left and right, that the traditional business model for banks of, you know, loaning money out and making money that way was something that just wasn't really viable for them, because as much money as they wanted to loan out, they had more deposits. People just kept putting more money into their bank. And so they not needed to start looking for other ways to make money. Right. Because as a bank, right, your primary job is to make money. Right. Your secondary job is to hold people's deposits. And what they ended up doing was looking for returns in a very conservative place. And because of government regulations, because of all the rules that we have about banks and how much money they need to have on hand for deposits and how they need to value their investments, they ended up in this pickle where they were forced to sell things at a loss. Even though if they held them to maturity, if they had held on and they had, you know, been able to see their investments through, they would have been fine. But because the rules said that they had to sell, that they had to raise capital, and they weren't able to get investors to give them more money, they had to sell at the wrong time, and they ended up selling at a loss, even though there was no reason why they should have lost money on those investments. And so what ended up happening was they had loans that they made to tech companies, to startups, and startups fail, right? That's a normal way of going about business, is that startups fail. They had just a large number of failures all at one time, which in and of itself wouldn't have been a problem, except that they didn't have enough cash on hand to then cover depositor needs, right? And the government says, well, you need to have a certain amount of cash on hand. And so they were forced to liquidate investments at a significant loss. In fact, it was about a $2 billion loss. Mm. And these are very conservative investments that will never lose money and are guaranteed and backed by the United States government, right? There's no reason why they should have lost money other than the fact that they were forced to sell by the government at the wrong time.
Everyone, we're talking with Leibel Sternbach about what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, two huge bank failures. And I know you just published an article where you compared what happened at Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, and about the dangers that retirees face. Can you tell us a little bit more about this article and what it means for us as retirees?
Yeah, so I find the parallels between what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and what happens with so many retirees. What I believe to be the biggest risk in retirement, which is being forced to sell our assets at the wrong time, I find the parallels uncanny in their similarities, right? Silicon Valley Bank, they had these assets, they had really low risk. They were investing in treasuries, right? Really low risk. It was basically the equivalent of a bank CD, except from the United States government. And it's, right, it's principally protected. You're not going to lose your money. and you're going to get interest, right? What's not to like about it other than the fact that if you need to sell it before it reaches maturity, then you are subject to interest rate risk, right? You are subject to the whims of the market. And that's what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. They had investments that were too conservative for the market. And the market was like, well, we can get better rates elsewhere. So you're going to sell it at a loss. And the same thing could happen to us in retirement. In retirement, the IRS comes along and says, well, we've got required minimum distributions, right? You have to take money out of your retirement accounts and we decide how much you have to take out and when you have to take it. Kind of like the banking regulations for Silicon Valley Bank that said you need to have liquidity on hand to cover your depositors. And if you don't, you're going to have to sell assets to raise the cash, right? I see that as being, you know, kind of the same. And so what happened was, just like the IRS comes to the retiree and says, well, you got to pay taxes. You got to take money out of your retirement account and pay taxes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter that the market's down. Doesn't matter that it's the wrong time. Doesn't matter that if you just held on 6 more months, you would be fine, right? And you'd be able to pay it and your retirement would be fine. No, you have to sell it today. You have to pay those taxes today. And if you don't, we're going to penalize you. In the case of Silicon Valley Bank, right, they took them over, right? They forced them to sell it at a loss, and then they took them over and put them out of business. In retirement, we don't want to be put out of business. And so we need to make sure that we're never in a position where the IRS comes to us and says, you have to take this money out of your account and liquidate it and pay taxes on it, even though it will hurt your retirement. Right. And I think that they're like the parallels are uncanny and the lesson is the same, right? That just like the bank needs to manage and hoard its cash, right? Its cash reserves and make sure that it always has enough money on hand and that it can always sell its assets, right? That it has enough cash flow to cover its depositors. In retirement, we need to make sure we have enough cash flow, right? And we have our assets invested in the right way so that when we need to take our money out, we're not taking it out at the wrong time. We're not compounding those losses that are in the market. And we don't turn those paper losses into real losses. And that's why I go through in the article that I just published. You can find it on my website, yieldsforyou.com. And I think it is the biggest lesson that every retiree needs to know, right? This is the central theme of retirement, is mastering this decision-making. And there has never been a better example of what happens when you get it wrong.
It's interesting. So is there a different caveat to this? Can you talk about the role that social media played in advancing fear about what was going on with Silicon Valley Bank?
So fear played a small role in what happened. I think it exacerbated the issue. We had this issue, right, that Silicon Valley Bank all of a sudden had to write off a bunch of investments, a bunch of loans, right? And so that all of a sudden made its balance sheet lower. And so they knew, right, okay, we need to raise cash. And they were looking for ways to raise cash. Now, here's what happened, right? The analysts who were watching Wall Street, the analysts who were watching the banks, they saw this coming along and they were like, you know, is this just the start of something else, right? Is there more to this than what meets the eye, right? And their fear, their, you know, kind of pondering of, you know, is there something else? Also, their trading of what they were doing kind of signaled other people that this bank may be in distress, which caused people to start taking their money out, right? So the people who were in the know started taking their money out. Now, Silicon Valley Bank, unlike other banks, because they cater to the tech sector, because they cater to startups, right? And the very nature of startups is you, especially Silicon Valley startups, is that you get a huge chunk of change from venture capitalists, and then you spend it over the course of the next few years, right? So the vast majority of the depositors in this bank had millions, tens of millions of dollars sitting in their accounts. Whereas your average typical bank, you think Bank of America, you think any of your hometown banks, Mm-hmm. Those banks are, you know, primarily catering to people who come to deposit their paychecks, right? So they don't have tens of millions of dollars, and it's not like you have 3,000 clients that have $100 billion, right? Or $200 billion in the case of Silicon Valley Bank. It was just only 3,000 depositors. That's a lot of money concentrated in a very small number of people. And so it doesn't take very many of them getting scared to drive up that capital requirement and go from it being like, well, we needed $2 billion to we need, you know, $10 billion or whatever that number was, because their cash started fleeing. And so there was essentially a run on the bank by a small number of people who were big enough to make movement. And honestly, again, right, their balance sheet, they probably could have done everything right. They probably could have shored up their finances if they had been given time. But the state of California said, we're not risking it. We're not giving you the ability to try to recover this. We're taking you over, right? You are the 16th largest bank in the country. We're not risking that you're going to fail.
So talk about the lessons that we can learn from what took place at Silicon Valley. What can retirees do differently? We have just a few minutes left. What can we do? What can we learn?
So the biggest lesson that I want you to take away is that success or failure in retirement, in life really, has nothing to do with how big your bank account balance is, right? This bank failed, and it failed for one simple reason. It did not have access to the cash when it needed it, right? Cash flow is more important than how much money you have, right? That income stream that you have in retirement, how do you get that income stream in a dependable, predictable manner that is sustainable throughout retirement, right? Because that's the key word over there, sustainable, right? The state of California looked at Silicon Valley Bank and said, we don't know that you're sustainable, even though you have all this money on your balance sheet. We're taking you over. In retirement, the federal government doesn't look at us and say, we think you're managing your finances bad. We're taking you over. No, they wait until you're at zero. And then you're lucky if you got city resources that will help you out, right? This is the challenge of retirement. The challenge of retirement is that we need to be good shepherds of our money. We have to be good stewards, and we have to make sure that we turn our finite sum of money into an essentially infinite stream in retirement. And the way we do that is by making sure that we don't take our money out at the wrong time. And that sounds simple, but as we see with Silicon Valley Bank, we're not always in control of when we have to take our money out in retirement. The IRS dictates when we have to take it out for required minimum distributions. Life dictates when we have to take it out because we have a sudden unexpected expense, right? The biggest fear that I have for my clients is that they will have a sudden and unexpected medical expense or home expense. You know, their basement gets flooded and all of a sudden they have to pay for, you know, $10,000, $15,000 to fix something. And it's not a large sum of money, but they take it from the wrong place at the wrong time, which is why having a plan is so important, right? It's not about what you have, but how do you access it in a sustainable and predictable way?
So should retirees in general be concerned? I know the government said that taxpayer dollars didn't help in the bailout or the supporting of Silicon Valley Bank. Is there any reason for concern in this space, Label?
So in the banking space, you know, itself, no, I don't think that there's really much to worry about. And when we talk about the amount of money that's involved, right, we're talking about $25 billion, right? That's nothing. $25 billion sounds like a lot, but it's not really a lot of money when we're talking about the federal government, when we're talking about, you know, our national economy. So am I worried about this spreading over and, you know, upsetting our economy and us going into another great recession or great depression? I don't think so, but we'll talk more about that in our next episode.
Thank you, Leibel. We look forward to hearing from you again next week. Leibel's website is Yields for You. That's yieldsforyou.com. Yields, the number four, the letter U.com. I'm Freddie Bell, and more New Beginnings is straight ahead. It's National Lacey Oatmeal Cookie Day. There are cookie holidays, and then there's the National Lacey Oatmeal Cookie Day. This holiday celebrates a delicate cookie made from oats. Some people may refer to this day as National Oatmeal Cookie Day. The difference between the two is that the Lacey Oatmeal cookies are wafer thin and typically accompany a scoop of ice cream or sorbet. In the early 1900s, oatmeal became a major ingredient in the American diet. Before that, Americans relied on other grains. Originating in England, oatmeal cookies have been around since the 1800s. However, it is believed that they were created after the oat cake. Soldiers used to carry oat cakes with them for a quick boost of energy during battle. Most research found that the first recorded oatmeal raisin cookie recipe was written by Fanny Merritt Farmer in 1896. Considered a health food, the cookies quickly became popular. By the early 1900s, a recipe for the delicious treats appeared on the containers of Quaker oats. They're an excellent source of iron and fiber. Bakers use many recipes to make Lacey oatmeal cookies. Additionally, home bakers bake them with a variety of oats, including old-fashioned oats, quick-cooking oats, oat bran, and oat flour. Today is National Oatmeal Lacey Cookie Day. If you'd like to learn more, visit my website. It's freddiebell.com. We'll be right back. As New Beginnings continues, we now take you to the spirituality portion of our program, where we introduce the senior minister of Unity South Twin Cities, the Reverend James Stacy. We now join Reverend Stacy with a program already in progress.
Look at where we've been. As we started that first week, looking at King as a man with a dream. With a dream. He had a dream for humanity, for the people close to him in his Black community, in the South, in his Southern Baptist tradition. The tradition I myself came out of. And he realized, and he encouraged the people, we cannot walk alone. We cannot walk alone. And though we often think of him as a leader in the civil rights movement, as a leader in social justice, to me his dream was even larger than that, because he encouraged people to follow the example of Jesus Christ, to do unto others as you would have them do to you. Or he would speak of the greatest commandment according to Jesus: love your God and love your neighbor as yourself. He taught us this connection that we all have as God's children, as God's family. Whatever our social background may be, whatever our place in the world, Dr. King strove to bring people together for a purpose, pursue a dream. Then we turn to Charles Fillmore, co-founder of Unity. And I gave him the title, I Have a Prayer. And I reminded you of the famous quotation, if you're a student of Unity, you have to learn it at some point along the way. As a minister in training, I certainly had to know Charles' story, his awakening, his turning point. Well, I reminded you, he was first amazed and inspired by his own wife's healing. That's why we call Myrtle Fillmore the mother of Unity, because she began the process. And Charles saw such a change in her health, in her purpose, in her focus. He said, I got to figure this out. But he described himself as a 19th century businessman, and he was going to look at the spiritual thing with some good logic. And so he began by studying traditions of spirituality throughout the ages around the world. It was really quite remarkable for a man in Kansas City, in the heartland, in the late 19th century to have been exposed to so much of the spiritual wealth of humanity through time and around the globe. But he heard a lot of different ideas about God, about God's will for humanity, about our place in creation. And so he said, in all this babble, all these teachers and ministers and gurus, in all this babble, I will go to headquarters. Haven't you heard people say, I'm going straight to the boss? But using his logical mind, he said, if this God they all talk about is spirit, and every human being, including himself, was a living spirit, a creation of God, then somehow we can communicate, or this whole religion thing is a fraud. But he didn't just expound on it. He did something about it. He said, I am willing every day to devote time to sitting in the silence, being willing to connect to this creative spirit. And he said he did it for a long time. I believe it was a couple of years before he felt any result, any connection. And then he claimed to feel a tingling in his body, almost like electrical current. And he began to be inspired by great spiritual ideas. Or he began to understand the words that Jesus offered. What did it mean to say, the Father and I are one? It meant the connection he was beginning to experience. He went on, he and his wife, developing the movement. They said people first in their neighborhood in Kansas City and then later throughout the city started gathering around in prayer circles. They taught the power of prayer because it was the essence of making this the individual with the infinite, with the source of all. As people gathered around them, they eventually realized they needed a home, a physical building to be constructed for their work. Why, that's just like Unity South 30 years ago, putting this building up so that we would have a home in which to gather, in which to learn together, pray together, and have fun together. Don and Sue will see to that after the service. I know they've got great goodies downstairs so we can have some fun and enjoy one another's company. But all that built up around the Fillmores, when they put up that first building in 1906, Charles invited everyone who chose to write an affirmation, a statement of truth, for this new building, this new home being constructed for Unity, invited everyone to submit their name and their positive statement. He had 19,000 of those that were sealed in the cornerstone there in Kansas City. By that time in 1906, the prayer ministry still existing today, we call it Silent Unity, is an organization willing to pray with people 24/7 all over the globe. Well, more than 100 years ago, they entered that new building. And you know what? There were already 10,000 people signed up as members of Silent Unity. The numbers just grew by leaps and bounds because it wasn't that Charles had magic or was a wizard, but somehow he communicated to people the power of making this connection. And although he spoke of turning within, going within, doing your inner work, he also taught that as you did that inner development, it opened you to see others as your neighbor. You were connected to other people because you could not realize this presence and power within yourself and not know that it was in everyone. And so after one of their early meditation groups, Charles came out of the meditation and said, "Unity. Unity is the name of our work." Why did he choose that word? Well, as he described it, he said, our whole work is about seeing the unity of spirit in all things.
You just heard a message coming from the Reverend James Stacy, the Senior Minister of Unity South in the Twin Cities. More information is found at their website at unitysouth.org. And here are today's words to the wise. Life is a song to sing. Today's words to the wise, life is a song to sing. That's our show, and thanks to our special guests for stopping by and sharing information that we hope can change lives. If you missed any of today's show, you can subscribe to our podcast or just Google Freddie Bell or stop by my website of the same name. Thanks for listening, and remember that each day is a chance for a new beginning. See you next week.